I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Craig Johnson. He's author of the Longmire Mystery Series, and his new book, the 11th in the series, is called Dry Bones. He will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Tuesday the 12th of May at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So this book starts with the discovery of a gigantic dinosaur skeleton, and at the same time, the murder of the man on whose land it was found. How did this story come to you?
You know, the book's been translated into like about a dozen languages, and so I spent a lot of time overseas doing tours like that. And there was a particular tour where we were in England my granddaughter was with us. And we went into the Museum of Natural History there in London, and they had a big Tyrannosaurus Rex. And I looked down, and there was a plaque there that said Niobrara County, Wyoming. And so I started paying attention at that point in time. And just about every major museum that has a Tyrannosaurus Rex exhibit, they came from our portion of Wyoming, of the Northern Rockies. And so I started thinking about it, and I thought, you know what, that's probably a pretty good storyline to utilize, because I was talking to a paleontologist friend of mine. He told me that, yeah, that's the case. And it brought to mind a case that happened over here in the Black Hills over in South Dakota, which involved the largest, most intact Tyrannosaurus Rex fossil ever found. It was by the name of Sue. And there was a great deal of controversy about it because the Black Hills Institute claimed it. The rancher whose land it was found on claimed it. He was an Indian rancher, and so the tribe claimed it. And then the federal government came in and said it was actually on lease land, and so it's actually the federal government's property. And it just sounded like such a Walt Longmire mystery. It sounded like something that Walt would probably be involved with. And so it was off to the races. It's Walt's, 65-million-year-old cold case,
right,
I guess, that he's working on. So,
well, and, I mean, I guess if you're involved in that world, you realize that there's a lot of money in dinosaur skeletons.
There is a lot of money in dinosaur skeletons. I think Sue actually went for $8.2 million to the Field Museum in Chicago. And that was a Sotheby's auction with the backing of, I think it was McDonald's and Walt Disney, that helped provide the money to get it into the Field Museum there in Chicago. And so there's a lot of money involved, and then again, there's a lot of politics and society involved too, because one of the things the book also kind of touches upon a little bit is the artifacts, that come from a lot of the tribes. A lot of people don't know that less than 20% of the materials that were taken, the antiquities and everything from the different tribes around North American Indians, have yet to be returned. I mean, 80% of them are still, out there in these museums. And I'm not talking just artifacts. I'm talking about actual, mummified bodies, of, tribal elders that are still in some of these museums. And so it's a little bit of a touchy situation, with a lot of the Native Americans, and rightly so, in my opinion.
And it's also, some of the arguments that go on are who's going to take the best care of it.
Exactly. And there's a lot of controversy about that. There's a lot of controversy about the way that these artifacts, have been dealt with. I guess there was a period in time, back in 40, 50 years ago, where they used arsenic and all of these other really harmful chemicals to, clean they had problems a lot of times, because a lot of these things were natural objects, that were made with natural animal parts and things like that. And so they had to use all of these different pesticides and things like that to keep the mites from getting them or the mice from getting them, or all these different things. Well, now the things have become so contaminated that you can't even handle them anymore. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword there. First we take your things away from you, and then we poison them so much that you can't even touch them anymore. So it's kind of a tough situation as far as that's concerned, but for me, that's one of the joys of writing the books. I mean, I like writing the books and having them have a social commentary or something important to say that maybe readers are not as knowledgeable about, rather than, just stacking up bodies like cordwood,
Well, and also it's, great material for mysteries in which people are being poisoned.
Exactly. Like that, when these things happen, the question becomes, okay, well, not only who did it, but how did they do it? So.
Right. Now, when you write a book like this, I'm sitting here reading it and learning about the fact that Wyoming is a place where many dinosaur fossils have been found and things about the preservation of these things over the years and so on and the politics of it. I assume that, and I'd love to hear your response to this. I mean, I assume as a reader that even though I'm reading a fictional book, those parts of it are accurate to the best of your ability, and to that extent we can actually learn from you know, learn some of those facts from the book.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's you know, that it would be criminal, you know, excuse the term, you know, to do anything else. I mean, I think that, you know, whenever you're providing, you know, factual, historical, you know, societal information, you know, for people that are reading your books, you kind of have to make sure that you get that right, because there's this entire mass of people out there, the correctionists, who are more than happy to write you an email and tell you what it was that you got wrong or what you said wrong, you know, in your books. Like, it's kind of twofold. You know, first of all, you don't want to get things wrong because those people will eat you alive. But then again, it's also important, you know, because, you know, I'm kind of, you know, providing an educational value for readers and giving them an even foot, you know, in trying to figure out the case the same way that, you know, that Walt is. And so to do that, I have to be honest with them, look at and give them the same, you know, type of honest information, you know, that the sheriff is working with to try and solve the case. And, you know, to me it's important, you know, for a lot of reasons. I mean, there's an awful lot of Indian interaction in my book simply because, you know, my county and my ranch are right up here next to the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow Reservation. And so it's very important that if I utilize aspects of their culture and of their society, it's very important to be respectful. It's very important to make sure that I get those things correct and make sure that I do them right. And I guess, you know, the same thing could be ventured, you know, into the scientific field, in the sense that, you know, you don't want to make up a dinosaur. You don't want to make up, you know, time periods or anything like that. You want to try and stay with the facts as much as you possibly can, because all that does is just enhance, you know, the reading experience of reading one of the novels, in my opinion.
When you said just a moment ago the reader is trying to figure out what's happening at the same time that Walt Longmire is trying to figure out what's happening, and I was thinking about how the books are written in the first person from Longmire's perspective. Is that intentional? Like, we are going on the journey with him? Like, you are giving the reader the opportunity to really be in his shoes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're getting the same information that Walt gets at the same time that Walt gets it, you know, all the way through. And one of the important aspects of writing crime fiction is to make sure that you do give the reader, you know, an even chance, you know, at trying to figure out who done it, the same way that you do the protagonist. You know, and for me, there's no better, you know, no better tense, you know, than first person, because some of the best stories that I've ever heard in my entire life have been in first person. When somebody, you know, tells you a story, there's an electricity, there's an energy to that that I think is very difficult for the other tenses, you know, to kind of, you know, compete with. And to be honest, I mean, you know, when I write my books, you know, in that first person tense, the way I write the books is almost as if you were going into the Busy Bee Cafe there in Durant, Wyoming, and you were to sit down on one of the stools, and all of a sudden the sheriff comes in and sits down on the stool beside you and says, you know, hey, let me tell you about what happened to me last month. Yeah. At that point in time, I don't want you to even remember that you're reading a book. I want you to just fall and submerge yourself into that world and become a part of that world. And, you know, the more detail that you use, you know, the more honest you are, you know, in your portrayal of the area, you know, the more humor you use. You know, I'm always asked by, you know, a lot of young authors, you know, well, you know, why do your books sell so well? Why did they decide to make a TV show out of your books and all these things? You know, well, you know, who do you like hanging out with? Who do you like spending time with? You know, maybe it's the people that, you know, make you laugh. I think that that's one of the things that makes the books, you know, the characters in the books a little bit more believable than, you know, the 6'2" of twisted steel and sex appeal. Every woman wanted him. Every man feared him. He could kill anyone with a Ticonderoga number 2 pencil in 3.2 seconds. Kind of character that you see, you know, in crime fiction so much. And in case you couldn't tell, my least favorite literary character, I just gave it to you. So.
We're talking to Craig Johnson, author of the Longmire series of mysteries. And I have to admit that I came to the books after watching the television show rather than the other way around.
Don't sound apologetic. Everybody's always really apologizing to me whenever they're writing me emails or talking to me at events. They're always like, I really didn't know about your books until I saw the TV show. That TV show is going out to like 6 million people a night,
yeah.
So I didn't expect to have the kind of coverage that they have. So it's pretty wonderful to have it, though, I have to admit.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting coming to the books after seeing the show, because I expected and sort of primed myself as I was reading to see the actors in my mind. But instead, I saw people who looked and felt different, and I'm not sure why, and I wondered what your experience was of this. I mean, do the characters in the TV stories and your stories diverge for you?
In small ways. In large ways, not so much, you know, because, I mean, I was writing the books, you know, for about 7 years before the television show, you know, came into being. And so, you know, most of the characters that are, you know, that are in my books, you know, they're based off of people I know. They're friends, their family, their neighbors, people I've worked with. And, you know, one of my favorite quotes, you know, in all of literature is the one by Wallace Stegner on Teaching Fiction, where he says, the biggest piece of fiction ever written is that disclaimer that's at the beginning of every book, that there's nobody in this book is based off of anybody alive or dead.
Right.
That's a crock. Okay, I mean, that's your job, you know, as an author, is to go and find interesting people and, you know, and populate your books with them like that. And, you know, for me, you know, a lot of those people are, you know, very close to me like that. And so, you know, when the actors came along, it was kind of a separate but equal universe is what it was. Like, you know, they were using a lot of the tone, a lot of the feel, a lot of the histories of the characters, you know, and all these things, you know, but they were a little bit different, you know, from what it was that I was used to for 7 years. But, you know, the job that they've done, I think, is pretty magnificent. You know, it's a pretty good group of folks. And, you know, they're very special individuals that a lot of people may not know. I mean, Lou Diamond Phillips, you know, I can't, you know, tell you how wonderful a human being he is. I can give you one example by saying I wrote the commencement speech for the Lame Deer High School in you know, up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, and they normally don't ask anybody from outside the tribe to do that, you know, but I wrote the speech for them, and then they told me when I was supposed to be delivering it, and I had to tell them I was on a book tour, and I was unable to deliver the speech, and they were disappointed, I was disappointed. A couple of weeks later, I was down on the set there in Santa Fe, and so I was, you know, doing, you know, talking with Lou, and the first thing Lou always asks whenever I'm on the set, he always comes over and says, "What's going on the res?" And I said, "Well, I wrote this commencement speech, you know, for the Northern Cheyenne, but I'm not going to be able to be there to deliver it." He didn't even pause. Look, at 2 weeks later, he flew into Billings, Montana, drove down to Lame Deer, Montana, and delivered the commencement speech for the Northern Cheyenne's high school. They had the largest crowd they've ever had for a commencement speech up on the res.
Right.
I don't know quite to make of that, but that just kind of gives you an indication of what kind of people they are. Like, they're just, you know, really charming, warm, you know, approachable people, and that's probably the best thing to have happen to me, I got to say.
Now, as many of our listeners know, the A&E Longmire series was canceled and then picked up by Netflix under intense pressure from loving fans, including yours truly. Now, from the viewer's perspective, do you think, I mean, is there a kind of seamless continuity from the previous incarnation? Are there differences?
Oh, absolutely. The continuity, you know, they're not going to monkey. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know, is the old, you know, adage. And, you know, this show was, like I said, you know, pulling in over 5 million people, you know, a night. And, you know, and there were some issues, obviously. A&E has some issues. I think they still need to work out. But the wonderful thing, though, was is that Netflix stepped up to the plate and said, you know what, we want this, and we want it bad. And the great thing about Netflix is they're so open to the idea of, like, you know, well, they don't care how long the episodes are because they don't have commercials. So you can do it as long as you want. And the continuity as far as where the show picks up, it's going to pick up only moments, you know, right after the last episode from the third season. And so they've been really, really wonderful to work with, and really don't, you know, put many, you know, codicils on, like, you know, how it is that the TV show should be or how it should be done or anything like that, which is a little bit different from, you know, from Network X, like that, you know, had a lot of input and had a lot of opinions about things, even though we were the highest rated scripted drama that they ever had. And so it's kind of a freeing thing, you know, to suddenly be with Netflix. I have to say, you know, they're just a magnificent group of people to be working with, and it allows us a lot more freedom as far as the scripts are concerned, as far as length is concerned. I mean, each episode is going to have like 20 minutes more, if not more, than that material, because, you know, network and on cable television, you know, it was only 42 minutes. Each episode was only 42 minutes, and for me as a writer, that's like writing haiku, you know, because I can't get anything done in 42 minutes. I need 400 pages, you know, to tell my stories. And so, you know, it's kind of wonderful that we're getting a full 20 more minutes of material per episode. It's almost like, you know, another 10 episodes, for gosh sake. So that's kind of nice.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, not having read most of the books in the series yet, there is this, I mean, you take a 300 or 400 or more page book, you can't really put it into a 42-minute episode. Do you stretch, I mean, do you use, I mean, how do you do that, or how do they do it?
Well, what one of the big things that they've done is you know, we've got some really wonderful writers on the show that are also producers for the show, Hunt Baldwin and John Coveney. And, you know, they're really, really good at getting to the pith and marrow of whatever it is that, you know, that one of my novels happens to be about. And they take that, and then what they do is they either, like, you know, have to cut out some things. I mean, there was one episode that they did, An Unquiet Mind, that was based, you know, almost exclusively off one of my books called Hell is Empty. And, you know, there were a lot of Dante references like that because Walt happens to be reading a paperback version of Dante as he's going up into the mountains to capture these criminals like that have escaped. And they said, you know, okay, we're getting rid of that whole, you know, sub-story. We're getting rid of this. And so it was kind of interesting to see how they have to kind of chop and channel it down to where it'll fit, you know, into that 42-minute schedule. The other thing that they do is they'll take bits and pieces. You know, they'll take, like, bits and pieces from a bunch of different books. Or one subplot from one of the books and turn that into an entire episode. And then, you know, they have to come up with some of their own like that. I mean, I think we're already at, you know, we're going to have like 40-some episodes. Well, I've only written 11 books,
right.
You know, so they kind of have to cut it down and use bits and pieces, and it seems to have worked pretty well for them.
Well, and you're always sending them, if I remember, because you spoke in Santa Fe once a couple of years ago, and I heard you there, and you used to, like, cut out newspaper clippings of things that have happened in Wyoming and stuff like that.
I do. It's too much of an opportunity. I mean, you know, New Mexico and Wyoming have a lot in common, in the sense that, you know, it's vast open spaces, you know, and I've got theories about that, you know, an awful lot of the time, the strange and the odd that can't survive, you know, in the mainstream of society tends to gravitate. You know, the old statement is that nature hates a vacuum. You know, like, well, the strange and the odd sometimes tends to float into those areas. And, you know, and those are the people that you want to write about. Those are the instances that you want to write about. I don't want to write about people who are driving the same cars to the same jobs to come home to the same houses and eat the same food. I mean, I want to write about people that are, you know, a little bit further out on the frontier, you know, of the human existence. You know, to me, that's, you know, where the best writing about the American West, you know, really kind of takes place. You know, some of our most, you know, finest, you know, Western writers that we have nowadays, Cormac McCarthy and Larry McMurtry and all these other people like that, they write about the people that are out there on the fringes. And, you know, and for me, that's the same, you know, approach that I try and take. Because those individuals are infinitely more interesting than anybody else.
When you start a new book, like you've finished this book, Dry Bones, now you're coming to Santa Fe tomorrow, you're talking to people. Okay, and then the tour is finished, you sit down, you start your next Longmire book. What is that like? I mean, you're coming back to characters who you know. Does it feel like they've had a bit of a life of their own while you were away? Are they waiting for you? Like, what's that like?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I've got some theories on that too. Like, I mean, the wonderful thing is like the first book in the Walt Longmire series, The Cold Dish, was just meant to be a standalone book. It really wasn't supposed to be a series of books at all. It was just going to be one book. I just thought, well, let me just get one book published. That's all I want in life. And Catherine Court, the president of Penguin USA in New York, sat me down like that, and she said, "We would like some more of these." And my response to that was, "I'm happy to write you guys some more books like that." And she patted the advanced reader copy of The Cold Dish and said, "I don't think you understand. We would like some more of these. We think these characters, this place, you know, everything about it, people are going to want more." And that's when I, with the knowledge of not even having had one book published, started arguing with the president of Penguin USA and saying, "Oh, I don't really think that'll work, but I've got some other ideas I want to bounce off of you." And she said, "Why don't you go back to your ranch in Wyoming and sit down and think about this?" And so I did. Like, and then the big question came back was, you know, do these characters have more stories to tell? Like, and the roaring answer came back that, yes, these characters do have a lot more stories to tell. And, you know, for me, that's one of the joys, you know, is that arc of knowing that I've got more time to develop, you know, and find out about the past of a lot of the characters. And not only just, you know, the major, you know, protagonists, you know, Walt and Henry and Vic and all those characters, but also the more minor characters like Lucian, like Ruby, like all of these other characters
yeah.
that are there. It gives you an opportunity to go back and find out more about them or what's going on in their lives now and have them more fully fledged, you know, as characters. As you go.
Very interesting. I mean, this phenomenon that so many writers talk about of characters almost having their own DNA and doing things that you didn't expect them to do. And, I mean, from your perspective, what is that?
Well, I think that there's, you know, a lot of there's a lot of woo-woo about that, in the sense that, you know, a lot of authors play into it a little bit where they say, well, the characters just start talking and they just write the book themselves. You know,
yeah.
I don't know about you, but it kind of worries me when people sit in rooms by themselves and hear voices. You know, and so for me, like that, I think that there's a psychological explanation for that, and I think that what it is that your psychological, you know, your present mind, like that, you know, the conscious mind that you write with, that's really kind of what's in control of the book. That's what, you know, we'll sit down and write the outlines, you know, and do the research and have the fingers on the keypad, you know, and it'll be doing the writing and all that. Well, you've got this other thing. It's called the subconscious mind. And your subconscious mind is just as aware of all of these things like as your conscious mind. But then again, it's a little more free because it doesn't have to deal with all those mundane day-to-day aspects of the writing process. And so I think, you know, whenever, you know, authors say, oh, the characters start talking to me, actually, you know, what it is, it's just your subconscious mind is all it is like that, because your subconscious mind is kind of like a backseat, like a person in the backseat of a car. You know, they don't have control over the steering, they don't have control over the brake or the accelerator, but they've got a voice, you know, and they can, you know, throw things over the back seat there just the same as any other backseat driver can.
You wrote somewhere that I read that for you, writing is kind of it's a job and you sit down and do it, and you don't sit around waiting for the muse any more than a ditch digger sits around thinking, oh, I'm just going to wait till I feel the ditch.
Yeah,
but
no,
at the same time,
ditch
digging is not quite as creative a process as writing.
Oh, I don't know. I've met some really creative ditch diggers in my life, so I can't make that statement. But no, I think, you know what a lot of it is a lot of it comes down to, you know, whether I think, you know, it is you really enjoy doing it or not. I mean, there are a lot of times, you know, I'll read interviews with authors that just despise writing. They just really hate it and don't want to do it. And I'm like, well, then you made a bad career choice, it seems to me, you know. I for one, you know, really enjoy the process of sitting down and writing. I mean, I've got a ranch, you know, and so, you know, I fight the irrigation, fight the stock, fight the, you know, the fence lines, you know, and the, everything like that. And so I do all of that stuff, you know, and working and doing ranch work, if I come into the house and I'm all, you know, angry and frustrated and everything from being out there and being bloody and knocked down and muddy and dirty and sweaty, and I come into the house, like, my wife will look at me and she'll say, go right, because everything is all better if I go right. I get back into that world. I get back into Walt's mindset, and it all becomes better for me. You know, for me, you know, writing is like, you know, breathing. It's one of the things that's essential, you know, to my day-to-day life, for my hour-to-hour life, for my moment-to-moment life, need be. And for me, that's part of the process, is just the enjoyment of it.
And my guess is that the two things complement each other. You probably wouldn't be writing the Longmire series if you weren't out there living on your ranch.
Yeah, but the first thing that most people ask me when I go on tour is they always say, do you really live in a town of 25? And, you know, generally I have to say, well, no, it's 23 tonight because my wife and I are here at this bookstore like that. But but the other thing is like, you know, I don't even live in the town of 25. It's just the nearest town to where I live, you know, where my ranch is, has a population of 25. You know, but I think, yeah, being up here, you know, in the Bighorn Mountains, you know, in northern Wyoming, you know, when I get back home, is always important to me like that, because that's, you know, that's Walt's world. You know, that's the world that Walt lives in. And it gives me, you know, an opportunity to see the things that Walt sees, to breathe the air that Walt breathes, you know, all of the things that, you know, that, you know, have an information, you know, in his life, like that. That's the same things that I'm writing with as tools on a day-to-day basis. It would be difficult, I think, you know, for me to try and write these books, you know, from Los Angeles or New York or Chicago or something like that. I'm kind of happy and like the focus that I have, you know, from being in one of the least populated counties, you know, in the least populated state in America.
I remember you're telling the story of, what was it, you were wearing a sheriff hat, like a Longmire sheriff hat that said Asaroka County on it, and some woman really thought it was real? What was
it? No, what happened was is I had, whenever I'm not wearing my cowboy hat, I've got, you know, one of the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department hats that we sell off of our website at CraigAllenJohnson.com. If you didn't know there was no 24th County in Wyoming, if you didn't know there was no Absaroka County, they looked pretty real. And so I had one on like that, and we were on a book tour, and I was heading up from the Buffalo Bill Museum over in Cody, going up to Billings to fly out, and we were going through Red Lodge, Montana. and I stop in, you know, because traveling with me is kind of like traveling with a trained bear. As long as the bear stays fed, we're all going to be okay. And so, you know, my wife makes sure that I eat properly, like, and, you know, get plenty of rest, you know, and so I don't become the bear. Like, and so anyway, we stop in to grab something to eat, and I go over and I'm writing a check for the lunch, and the woman behind the counter at the cash register, she looks at me and she says, "Where'd you get that hat?" And she said it really kind of aggressively, and I thought, oh, no, she thinks I'm a real sheriff's deputy, and somebody's dined and ditched, and I'm going to have to go chase somebody down the main street of, you know, Red Lodge, Montana. And I looked at her, and I pointed at my head, and I said, "It's not a real county." And she goes, "The hell it's not. It's Walt Longmire's county."
Right.
So evidently the long arm of the law of Walt Longmire reaches much further as far as television is concerned than books do. Like that. And so I looked at her and I said, "Well, I'm Craig Johnson." And she goes, "So?" And I said, "I'm the one that writes the books." She goes, "What books?" And I said, "The books the TV show is based off of." She goes, "Oh, there are books?" You know? So
yeah, yeah.
I've told Viking Penguin that's going to be our motto from now on whenever I go on tour. Yes, there are books.
Yes, there are books. Craig Johnson is author of the Longmire series of mysteries. His 11th book in the series is called Dry Bones, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Tuesday the 12th of May at 6 in the evening. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Absolutely, my pleasure. And the coffee's really good, too.
Yes, indeed.
Ha ha ha.